Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
WNYC with our family meeting on sleep today. And now a deeper dive on what to do about your insomnia. Our next guest is Shelby Harris, the director of the Behavioral Sleep Medicine Program at Montefiore Medical Center and an advisor to WNYC's Clock Your Sleep Project. Dr. Harris, welcome to the Brian Lehrer Show.
Thanks so much for having me.
So listeners, if you struggled with insomnia or have had trouble staying asleep through the night in the past but figured out what helps you sleep, give us a call at 212-433-WNYC. And if you want the benefit of Dr. Harris's expertise, call in with your questions. Your questions welcome here, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692, or post to WNYC.org, click on Brian Lehrer Show. So Dr. Harris, you specialize, as I said, in cognitive behavioral therapy to help people sleep. What is that exactly and how does it work?
Okay. So CBT, or cognitive behavior therapy for insomnia, we call it CBTI, is really considered in the sleep field the gold standard treatment for insomnia right now. Problem is, there aren't a lot of people who are specially trained in it. So when we think about CBTI, it's really the cognitive part and the behavioral part. So a lot of people who have insomnia, what happens over time is that they start to change behaviors that they normally would do before they ever had sleep problems. So people might start going to bed earlier or sleep in the morning or sleep in on the weekends, napping, trying to catch sleep whenever they can. They also start to lay in bed longer amounts of time. They might watch TV in bed or start to try and force sleep to happen, have more caffeine. So we really try to change the behaviors that they're doing that are getting in the way of their sleep, as well as worries about sleep. So people start to worry, I won't be able to function tomorrow, and they get very anxious at night. So it's a very short-term treatment for most people, 4 to 12 sessions of changing the behaviors and the thoughts about sleep. And it's just as effective as medications in the short term.
Give me an example of how you try to eliminate people's worry about not being able to sleep, because it's such a self-reinforcing cycle. You don't get enough sleep. You don't get enough sleep again. You think it's a chronic problem for you. So then you worry about not being able to get enough sleep. And that in itself keeps you up. But it's a legitimate worry. So how do you just tell yourself, try not to try?
Right. So what we notice is when people, I think the fact that we're doing all this sleep diary data and tracking your sleep is really helpful. What we notice for many people is that if you go one night of really bad sleep or even no sleep for some people, which is pretty unusual, usually by the second night and usually even more so by the third night, you tend to get more sleep. So I usually have patients kind of repeat a mantra to themselves that if I don't sleep tonight, I'll sleep better tomorrow. And if not, then by the third. And sometimes knowing that you can't control the sleep and kind of giving it up to your body and your body will sleep with the behavioral changes you make can kind of let the pressure go a little bit and the worry.
So that's the cognitive part.
Exactly.
Understanding that.
Understanding that you can't always make yourself go to sleep even though you want to.
And then what's the behavioral part?
So the behavioral part that I see most often is patients with insomnia, they tend to spend too much time in bed awake. So they're laying there 8 hours in bed, but they're only sleeping 4 or 5 hours a night. So what we actually do is we limit them, within reason, to a certain amount of hours that they're sleeping at night. We usually don't do less than 4 or 5 hours, but you're laying in bed 8 hours. You're 3 hours of the night. You're laying there tossing and turning. So I'd rather people go to bed later but get up at the same time every day. And when they start falling asleep faster and staying asleep more, then we slowly increase the time in bed that they're allowed. And that works very well for a number of insomnia patients.
And so if you're going to let yourself off the hook from worrying about sleep, mm-hmm. it means you just have to kind of have a more relaxed attitude about how crappy you feel during the day after you haven't gotten enough sleep?
That's a really good point. You know, you have to be realistic about it. So patients, I often think that at 3, 4 in the morning, I know for myself, the rational side of our brain is not always taking over. So we wake up and we often think to ourselves, how am I going to get through tomorrow? I'm not going to be able to function. I won't be able to do anything. But if you really work with someone or you think about it yourself, you think realistically. So maybe you won't be at 100% functioning level, but maybe 70% of you. Maybe you'll get through work. You might not do as great as normal, but the catastrophizing part probably isn't going to be there. So if you can get through that part, it will help you function the next day.
Glenn in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC, Brian Lehrer Show Family Meeting on Sleep. Hi, Glenn.
Hi, Brian. Big fan, been listening for years.
Thank you.
I am a chronic insomniac, and one of the tricks that I've used that sometimes works to help me get to sleep is to count back from 100 or even 200 if it's not working by 7.
I think that's a great technique that you use. There's something that we like to think of as cognitive distraction. I think that's a really good technique of cognitive distraction. And sometimes patients find that just counting by numbers, like 99, 98, is not distracting enough, that actually have some patients count backwards by 3s or by 7s, and they find that that can help even more. But if you have a constant thought loop in your head before you go to bed at night, doing something like the numbers or visual imagery can actually be really helpful to get in the way of the thoughts.
So this is the most stereotypical, classic sleep aid that you could think of. This is like counting sheep.
Exactly. And there is a lot of benefit to counting sheep. Just some people find it's very silly and they do something else.
So something repetitive like that to kind of lull yourself to sleep. Does the rhythm kind of matter?
You know, I think the rhythm can be beneficial because it can, like you said, lull yourself to sleep. But what I like is something that's focused, that has movement to it. So counting sheep, you're counting and you're picturing them going over, you know, the fence. Counting backwards, there's movement to it. So you're having some sort of focused imagery or thought process.
Joan in Manhasset, you're on WNYC. Hi, Joan.
Hi. I go to sleep very quickly, sleep very deeply. I read before I go to bed. I don't have television in the room. I'm exercising, all the good things I do, you know.
You're so much better than everybody. No, I'm kidding.
But I sleep for 2 hours, almost like a clock, and I'm awake, and then I don't go back to sleep. I guess my anxiety is beginning to extend because I hear so much about I'm supposed to have 7 or 8 hours sleep, and I'm wondering about zones, or you talk about blocks. It almost feels like macular degeneration where the center goes, and I sleep so well at the beginning, and then maybe at 4, 5, I go back to sleep for a little bit, but I get up at 6, so, you know, I'm up then. Now, sometimes I know that I'm worrying, but sometimes I'm not, and yet the pattern remains. And yet I function during the day. I seem to be okay, and I keep saying to myself, maybe I'm not okay because everything says I should be sleeping longer. And those 2 hours I know are very deep. I don't think I hear anything during those 2 hours. Could it be that that is enough sleep for me?
Well, I think that's a really interesting point that you bring up with the 7, 8 hours. I find that with patients with insomnia, they often focus on that. I need to get the 7 hours because so-and-so said so. What we know is that the majority of people need between 6 and 9 hours of sleep a night. So that's the majority of people to feel well-rested and refreshed during the next day. But there are people who are outliers who need less and some people who actually need a lot more than 8 or 9 hours a night. 2 hours is more on the extreme range, but you said also that you go back to sleep later on for a little while at 4, 5, 6 in the morning. So what might be something that you could think about also is how do you feel the next day? You said you're feeling okay during the next day, but if you're noticing that maybe you're having some memory issues or you're feeling fatigued at certain points, that's something to consider. And also, I don't know your exact sleep schedule history or anything, but maybe going to bed a little bit later, sometimes we find for some people going to bed later helps to push the awakening later, and then you might sleep a little later in the night.
Joan, thank you. Good luck. Are there different cognitive behavioral techniques for getting back to sleep than for originally getting to sleep?
I think that the things that work the best, one thing that's simple that many people do but does get in the way is looking at the clock. So everyone gets up in the middle of the night, they look at what the clock time is, and then they start doing the math. Oh, I've taken 4 hours to fall asleep, and now I finally fell asleep. Math does not help me get sleepy. I don't think it helps a lot of people get sleepy. So stop looking at the clock. And then what you were saying about what we were saying earlier about going to bed later, sometimes going to bed later can help push the awakening later, but you've got to keep the wake time the same 7 days a week. That's key.
Here's a related tip, I think, from a commenter on our website. Mm-hmm. Maria from Brooklyn writes that her brother told her that their dad told him, don't worry about falling asleep, just lying still and resting your body is good enough. And she says, when my mom scoffed at this and said my dad had given useless advice, my brother said, true or not, because he told me resting was good enough, I was able to stop worrying and sleep.
Ah, that's really interesting. I mean, it's the, I think it's like you were saying, the taking the worry out of it is what really helps a lot of people, even though we're constantly bombarded about you have to do this, you have to do this. Laying in bed, though, for long amounts of time and just resting is not – I mean, it feels better than just getting up and doing things, but laying in bed for prolonged amounts of time teaches your body that the bed is a place to lay awake and to think. So we actually prefer patients to get out of bed.
Really? That surprises me.
It's, you know, I think of a lot of cognitive behavior therapy for insomnia as being the anti-common sense treatment because we say, oh, we need to catch sleep when we can. But really, getting out of bed and going sitting somewhere else in dimly lit room and doing something to pass the time that's remote, that's mildly pleasurable, like reading a magazine or listening to music or doing relaxation stretches, that is better than laying in bed because laying in bed just continues to teach yourself the bed's a place to worry and to lay awake.
And it's also counterintuitive, I think, to go to sleep later in order to get more sleep, the thing you said before, as opposed to if you're tired at 9:30,
right,
just go to sleep at 9:30. It's kind of weird for an insomniac to purposely keep themselves up for
right.
a couple of more hours.
It is, and especially with patients that I have who have trouble falling asleep at night, when I give them the idea of saying, well, maybe we're going to go to bed at midnight or 1 in the morning, and they look at me like I have three heads, I say, well, what's your concern? They say, well, how am I ever going to stay up until 12 or 1? I look at them, I say, well, you're cured.
Problem solved, yeah.
Yep.
Dion in Mount Vernon, you're on WNYC. Hi, Dion.
Hi, how are you? Thanks for having me.
Thank you for calling.
I have two points that I'd like to make. One, the first thing, I think it is mainly cultural. And secondly, I'll tell you how I deal with my culture shock and how I force myself to sleep. I'm a Jamaican. When I used to live in Jamaica, I had no problem sleeping because, one, the conditions were conducive to sleep when you want to sleep, and that is usually at night. Now that I've relocated to the United States, and in particular New York, what I notice is that my preoccupation with just about everything has soared significantly. I'm overwhelmed with a whole lot of things that I call unnecessary. And in my home situation, there is so much inundation of information passing right, left, and center. There's a radio and a television on in every single room. And what that does is that I get so overwhelmed with a whole lot of information that I'm processing that by the time I go to sleep, I think I am processing all of these things, thinking about all my day, and I get all excited again lying in bed, so I can't sleep. But in Jamaica, that wasn't the case. When it is bedtime, I did not have a television in my room. When it was bedtime, it was bedtime. When it was sleep time, it was sleep time. And I would usually go to bed by 10:30, the latest. Here, I'm going to bed at 2.
So, Dion,
so what do I do?
Dion has stepped into our wired, technologically overexposed world in the New York area, it sounds like.
Very much so.
Yes, and there are lots of sirens. Everywhere you go, there are sirens. There's horn tooting. There are so many, many sounds. Too many sounds, a cacophony of sounds everywhere that you go. So you're always constantly alert.
Dion, hang on a second because my producer wants to ask you a question off the air. But first, let's give Dion some advice. And that culture shock, I wonder how many immigrants to New York, whether they're from other countries or whether they're from central Iowa somewhere, have the same experience.
This is something my main practice is at Montefiore Medical Center, and this is something I hear all the time. When I lived so-and-so other place, this was never a problem until I came to New York City. I think the big thing we have to think about, which Dion had just mentioned, is she doesn't really get to process her day until right before it's time to go to bed. And sleep is not an on-off switch, although we'd like it to be because there's not enough time in the day. You really need to allow for a good half hour, ideally an hour, to let your brain decompress, and ideally without screens, to really let your brain know that the end of the day is coming near. And at the beginning of that hour, that's when you want to maybe – some patients actually benefit from journaling. Just think about your day and process it at that point, because if you try to process it right before bed, there's no way your brain's going to shut off.
But let me play devil's advocate here. If I'm journaling before going to sleep, then I might be thinking about all the issues in my day, which might keep me up.
Right.
If I turn on the television and put on some mindless old sitcom rerun or something, maybe I'm going to fall asleep.
Right. I think the screen can be a tricky issue. If you're someone who has trouble falling asleep and you're very alert at night, the screen isn't always ideal. It is something that can then take your mind off of things. But if it's really not helping, there are things like actually you can buy blue blocker glasses, things like that you can wear so you can watch TV if it's a mindless episode to help.
Jim in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. You use some kind of media to go to sleep? Jim? All right, we'll try to get back to Jim. See, yeah. I tried to make such a perfect segue with what Jim had told our screener, but he wasn't there. I want to ask you about white noise.
Sure.
White noise, they say, has helped lots of babies stay asleep while the rest of the family is still awake and making noise. And a lot of people, grown-ups, swear the white noise machines help them fall asleep. There are sounds available. We're going to play some sounds.
Great.
Okay. From a particular white noise machine. It's the Conair SU1W sound therapy machine. This is not to recommend it or say that there are other ones that are worse or better. But it's the number one seller on Amazon, available for $19.99 with free shipping, they say. Did anyone out there – all right. So let's – we're going to play some different sounds from this machine right now. Okay, the first one is what they call birdsong. Now I know why they call it birdsong.
Calming.
Heartbeat. Babbling brook. That's too loud for me. I think it's going to come over the shore and flood my tent. The next one is waves. And finally, the one that the SU1W sound therapy machine just calls white noise. What makes this noise white?
Oh, gosh. I mean, what I like about this noise is there is no – it's just very constant. There is nothing else coming in. So when you're thinking about the other things we listen to, the wave, the heartbeat, the bird, there are little – it's not constant. There's little noises here and there, different
– there's a lot of bass here.
Yeah, exactly. I actually, in all honesty, I use a white noise machine to sleep at night, and I love it. It. I started using it about 6 months ago, and it drowns out any outside noise for me. And I wouldn't say I need it to go to sleep, but it's definitely something missing that I can hear outside noises even more when I don't have it on. I love it.
Is it the nature of the noise itself is conducive to sleep, or that it blocks out other noises that are more coming and going?
I think it's a mix. I think the constant noise itself is what can help lull some people to sleep. But I think the bigger thing, especially here in New York City, is there are a lot of noises outside. And if you have a white noise machine, it can help. Now, that being said, there was a controversial or a study that came out recently that looked at white noise with babies and said that some people are using these machines way too loud, that it's actually hurting the hearing on some young children. There's nothing like that for adults, though. So I usually will keep my white noise machine outside by the door. And it's pretty good at blocking noise if that is an issue for you.
It's our family meeting on sleep on The Brian Lehrer Show. Join our Clock Your Sleep project at wnyc.org/sleep. That'll be going on through the month of April. My guest, Dr. Shelby Harris, the director of the Behavioral Sleep Medicine Program at Montefiore Medical Center, and Amy in Harrington Park. You're on WNYC. Good morning, Amy.
Good morning. I discovered a way to get back to sleep when I was pregnant 19 years ago. When I would wake up to go to the bathroom, as all pregnant women do, I found that if I could just keep any image or memory from a dream that I was having, when I got back into bed, if I could, you know, like a color, an image, anything, I would go right back to sleep. And I find that continues to work for me.
I think that's a great technique to use, and that's something I use, something similar to a lot of my patients, that it's that focused cognitive task that is not very exciting, but at least takes your mind off of anything else that can really help to bring sleep on.
Amy, thank you. Yes, pregnant women and middle-aged men all wake up to pee.
Oh, yes, very common. And women going through menopause, too. Huh. It's very common then.
Raj in Basking Ridge, you're on WNYC. Hey, Raj.
Hi, Brian. Great show. I'm a long-time listener.
Thank you.
Quick question about sleep. How does sex help sleep? And also, if I'm doing it, like some days if I don't, then I'm afraid that I shouldn't be using this as a way to get more sleep.
Well, are you saying that your experience is that if you have sex, then you sleep better?
Yes.
Is it best to do that for you just before going to sleep?
Yes.
I think there's a variety. I've seen both happen. I've seen a lot of patients who say that sex is a stress reliever for them, and they find that that actually helps them go to sleep. Other people, though, on the opposite, have the opposite reaction. They find it's too alerting. So then we have to recommend that you have sex earlier in the day, because if it's really going to be alerting, then you probably shouldn't be doing it before bedtime.
Note from the doctor, sex can be arousing.
There you go.
Figure that out. What's your approach to medication? Because I know you're a behavioral cognitive therapist, so obviously we've been focusing on that. But when do you tell your patients to start on it? Or do they all come to you after Ambien or some such thing and the natural melatonin and whatever other, you know, health food store stuff have already failed them?
Right. The ideal, really, and I like to go by the sleep medicine guidelines, is to really try to do CBTI if possible. And there's nothing else that's really going to get in the way of being able to do it.
CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy without drugs.
Yep. We try to do that first. It's ideal so you're not having to use medication. If you're not responding in 4 to 5 sessions, then we do go the medication route. That being said, I'm at a sleep center, and people don't come to a sleep center right off the bat. So the majority of people I see at the sleep center have gone to their primary care doctor, have tried everything under the sun, nothing works, so then they end up with me. I normally see people who are on meds, but they don't work as great as they'd like or they'd like to get off them. That's when they usually come to me.
How about alcohol? I know somebody who says alcohol is definitely a sleep aid.
Alcohol does make you sleepy. That's why a lot of people will use it. They'll have that glass of wine or whatever before bed. The problem with alcohol is it makes the quality of your sleep really poor. So people might have more awakenings at night, or they'll just not feel as refreshed in the morning. So it's actually a really terrible sleep aid to use throughout the night.
Why does it make the quality of your sleep poor?
It wears off. So it wears off. So your body then basically wakes up craving more alcohol. And we all know that that is not a good technique to get into to sleep.
Darlene in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Darlene.
Hi. Two things. One, and I don't think anybody has mentioned these, and yes, I stay awake. I wake up. But before I go to bed, if I can take a hot bath, and they're old news, not to wash, but literally just to soak in a hot bathtub, I find I'm falling asleep. And when I go to sleep, if I now wear the blindfolds over the eyes, which, you know, I used to laugh about on I Love Lucy, I think she wore them, I find that when I wake up, I have to go to the bathroom, but once I go back to bed, if I don't see the light and somehow the blindfolds keep it darker, I am able to go back to sleep faster, to the point where if I don't have those, I sleep worse than if I did have them. So I just wanted to put those two suggestions out there. They're inexpensive, they're cheap, and they really do work for me.
Darlene, thank you. And you know you live in Brooklyn when you have to wear a blindfold to keep out the light at night.
Right. I think the interesting thing that she also brought up was the hot baths. So there was a number of studies done in Japan a while ago that actually looked at people who took hot 20-minute hot baths about an hour and a half to 2 hours before bedtime. And that has been shown to help induce sleep. It has to do with our body temperatures and circadian rhythms, but it can help. Right before bed for most people can actually make your mind calm, but it can be physically too alerting. But an hour and a half before bed is really very beneficial for people.
Deborah in Newark, you're on WNYC. Hi, Deborah.
Oh, hey, hello. There is a third leg to this three-legged stool you all have not introduced yet. We've done the medical, the overt medical, you know, the sleep apnea and the obesity. Now we're doing the behavioral and the cognitive.
Right.
But you've not gotten to the matter of recent science paralleling this in the 90s of sleep clocks. Sleep clocks are a vital issue in resetting sleep that has not been factored in or presented now. And I know about this personally over a lifetime. In when I was 12, I apparently had the disruption of a sleep clock that made it very difficult until the late 90s, we're talking from the 60s to the 90s, to have any kind of regulated sleep.
What do you mean by sleep clock?
Well, I didn't know what it was, but let me explain the symptom, then you'll understand what the issue is.
Okay.
I couldn't fall asleep, And then when I fell asleep, I could not wake up. And since I lived such a high-performance, high-functioning life, that was devastating. And so you would have the cart put before the horse. Well, you can't sleep because you have these psychological issues. So let's figure out the issues and the behavior, and then you can sleep. So I spent decades doing that. It didn't work. Until I had a primary in the 90s, a primary physician who'd read an article about maybe disrupted sleep clock. And so she gave me 25 milligrams of amitriptyline beginning in the late 90s. And within 2 years, I was sleeping normally for the first time by 2001. I don't even take the med anymore. I can go to sleep whenever I want. I can wake up wherever I want. This did not happen until the sleep clock was identified. And yes, I dealt with issues of depression because I couldn't do the work I wanted to do. Mm.
And does the depression come from the lack of sleep, or does the lack of sleep come from the depression?
Right.
But what about this idea of a sleep clock? Are you familiar with that concept?
So what I think the caller is referring to are circadian rhythms. So that's that 24-hour kind of clock that's built into our body that tells us when to go to sleep and when to wake up. Now, what a lot of people have is what it sounds like she might have had was a delayed sleep phase issue, meaning that people with that problem can get a full night's sleep, but it's not on the timing that you would ideally like. So if you want to go to bed at 11 o'clock, this person or someone else might not be able to actually fall asleep until 4 or 5 in the morning and then sleep until 1. But as we know, many people need to be up much earlier than that to start their day. So there are different treatments. They're somewhat different from insomnia that can be used to reset sleep clocks or your circadian rhythm for these problems. And they can be very effective.
Deborah, thank you and good luck. It's our family meeting on sleep. All right. Who out there works the night shift? Evenings, overnights, anything you would call the night shift. We're going to clear the board of all other callers, and we're going to take your stories and questions for Shelby Harris now about working nights and sleep. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692, the night shift and your sleep coming up in a minute.